Well, we have just 2 weeks left in our study of the life of Jesus as told by Luke. This week, we are going to be looking at the trial and the execution of Jesus. And then next week, we'll be looking at the burial and the resurrection of Jesus, and appropriately so, since next Sunday will be Easter. Last week, we read Jesus' prediction of Peter's denial. We read of Jesus' prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. We read of Jesus' arrest by the temple guard, and then the actual denial by Peter of ever knowing Jesus when he was challenged by people in the courtyard where the initial trial of Jesus was taking place. The last words that we read were difficult, knowing the profound sense of failure that Peter was certainly struggling with in that moment when the rooster crowed, causing Peter to remember Jesus' prediction of his denial. It says, he went outside and wept bitterly. When Jesus was arrested, he was taken to the house of the high priest Caiaphas, where he faced a number of preliminary examinations by the religious leaders. It was not allowed in Jewish law at that time to conduct a formal trial on a capital charge at night, so they had to wait until daybreak to hold their formal council. While waiting for that formal trial to be convened, Jesus was being held by the temple guard, and this is where we pick our story up this morning in Luke 22, verse 63. It says, the men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, prophesy, who hit you? And they said many other insulting things to him. Try to remember who this is that's taking this abuse. This is the Son of God, the one who formed the worlds with his command, the King of all creation, the Lord of lords, the King of kings, the Lion of Judah, the Prince of Peace, the mighty God. Jesus says nothing. He does nothing. 1 Peter 2:23, it says, when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. It's now daybreak. The formal trial before the Jewish authorities can be held. And it says in verse 67, if you are the Christ, they said, tell us. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. They all asked, are you then the Son of God? He replied, you are right in saying I am. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips. They had been unable to get even two false witnesses to agree during the night's proceedings. They hoped that Jesus will condemn himself with his own words. So they ask him directly, are you the Christ? And Jesus responds that they have refused to accept and believe what he has been telling them up to this point. Nor have they been willing to answer his questions. They really don't want to know the truth. They are only interested in finding reason to condemn him. Whatever answer he gives will be twisted to serve their aims. So when they ask him, are you the Son of God? He answers with resignation, knowing that they are so heavily driven by a desire to have him killed that it doesn't matter what answer he gives. He could have said, I'm a fried egg. And they would have shouted, blasphemy! You've heard it! Why do we need any more testimony? This whole trial was a total sham. Luke spends very little time on the trial before the Jewish authorities compared to the other gospel writers. If you're interested in reading more of the detail, you'll have to read the other three gospels. In verse 1, it continues, it says, then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, we have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king. The Jewish religious leaders have concluded their trial and condemn Jesus. They now take him to Pilate, the Roman governor. The Romans granted the Jews the authority to try and convict their own people for virtually everything except capital crimes. Death penalty cases had to be presented to the Roman authorities and carried out by them. This is why the Jewish authorities bring Jesus to Pilate, the Roman governor. They're faced with a small problem here, though. The Romans would not consider blasphemy a punishable crime. That was a religious matter, and the Romans could care less. So the Jewish authorities charged Jesus with high treason, which would be something that the Romans would indeed be interested in. They accused Jesus of subverting the nation, it says, of opposing the payment of taxes to the Romans, and claiming to be Christ, a king. It's ironic, I think, that the Jews accused Jesus of being the very kind of Messiah that he had repeatedly refused to be, a political Messiah. Jesus was indeed the king of the Jews in a spiritual sense, but he had refused to let the people put him in that position on a political basis. But here they are throwing him into that position as they lead him before the Roman authorities. Pontius Pilate was the Roman governor over Judea from AD 26 to 36. Pilate is described by historians of that era as one who was greedy, inflexible, cruel, and who resorted to robbery and oppression. He's known to have treated the Jewish customs with great contempt. Almost immediately upon his arrival in Palestine, he was at odds with the Jews. He thought of the Jews as a bunch of religious fanatics. He had very strong prejudice against them. They didn't like him. He didn't like them. And I think knowing this creates a very interesting backdrop for the interaction between the Jewish authorities and Pilate. In verse 3 it says, "So Pilate asked Jesus, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' 'Yes, it is as you say,' Jesus replied." So his first question to Jesus is, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answers his question with a yes. Although the understanding of what that means are literally worlds apart between these two men. In verse 4, then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. See, Pilate, he sees right through what the Jewish leaders are trying to do with Jesus. He knows that they haven't arrested Jesus out of loyalty for the Romans. He isn't stupid. He also knows that he doesn't want to get in the middle of all of this stuff. So when he hears that Jesus is from Galilee, he takes the opportunity to duck out and send him to Herod, who was in charge of that region, who happened to also be in Jerusalem at that time, probably for the Passover celebration. Verse 8, it says, "When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had wanted to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer." So Herod was initially excited to see Jesus. He had heard many things about him. He had wanted to be able to get some kind of first-hand look at this person. So as Jesus is brought into him, it's almost like he's a monkey on a leash. He's hoping to see Jesus perform some kind of miracle tricks. And I have a suspicion that these questions that he asked of Jesus were along the same line. They were probably questions like, "What's the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow?" Some of you know where that line comes from. Jesus doesn't play along, though. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him, dressing him in an elegant robe. They sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Herod quickly grows tired of this whole affair. So he and his soldiers make a mockery of Jesus instead, putting a royal robe on him, slapping him around, and then sending him back to Pilate. And sometime during all of this is when a crown of thorns is put on his head, he's spit on, and he is gang-beaten in every way imaginable. Verse 13, it says, Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers of the people, and said to them, You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him. Pilate again tells the Jewish leaders that he finds no basis for the charges that have been brought against him. Furthermore, he says Herod has found no basis for the charges brought against him, so he's going to punish him and then release him. Now, having him punished was not a walk in the park, as we'll talk about in a moment, but this is not satisfactory for the Jewish leaders. Verse 18, it says, With one voice they cried out, Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us! Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, Crucify him! Crucify him! A tradition had been established as an act of goodwill on the part of the Romans toward the Jews during their Passover celebration. One of their countrymen who was in the Roman prison would be fully pardoned and released to them. Pilate is hoping to use that tradition to have Jesus released in spite of the wishes of some of these Jewish religious leaders. But the Jewish leaders are not about to let a loophole like this get in the way of their plans. The Jewish leaders incite the crowd that has gathered there to shout that they want Barabbas released rather than Jesus, and they want Jesus executed. Barabbas was a man truly guilty of trying to lead a rebellion against the Romans, and he had actually murdered someone in the process. He was in prison awaiting execution at that time. But the crowd starts shouting and chanting in reference to Jesus, Crucify him! Crucify him! Verse 22, it says, For the third time he, Pilate, spoke to them, Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him. So for the third time, Pilate tries to release Jesus, but the crowd will have none of it. Verse 23, but with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. So Pilate finally gives in to the demands of the crowd. He sees he's getting nowhere with them, and the last thing that he needed was an incident with the Jews. He had already gotten himself in trouble with those over him in his poor handling of the Jews in the past. He didn't need more trouble for himself. Pilate turns Jesus over to the executioners who first have Jesus flogged. The person was first stripped naked, had their hands tied around a post. The whip that was used had several leather straps with sharp bits of bone or metal interwoven into it, and there were usually small metal balls attached to the ends of these straps. The whip was designed to cut into the person's flesh, ripping it as well as bruising it. Two men, one on each side of the person, usually did the flogging. The soldiers doing the flogging were trained professionals who knew the best way to administer the flogging so that the pain and the suffering were maximized, but at the same time keeping the person receiving the punishment alert and alive. They didn't want the person passing out or dying on them too quickly. Jewish tradition limited the flogging to a maximum of 40 strikes. The Romans, though, didn't have any such limits. Sometimes the person receiving a Roman flogging didn't survive to even be crucified. They were literally flogged to death. So Jesus is already severely injured by the time he is led out to be crucified. In verse 26, it says, As they led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. It was common for the condemned person to be made to carry his own crossbeam to the place of execution. It was just another way of humiliating the condemned person. But Jesus is apparently too injured already to manage that. So the soldiers grab a man named Simon from Cyrene, and they make him carry the crossbeam for Jesus. Verse 27, it says, a large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, blessed are the barren women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed. Then they will say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry? There was the crowd of people who had squeezed in to watch the trial and participate in the condemning of Jesus, who had shouted, crucify him, at the cue of the Jewish leaders. But there was also another crowd of people, the people who loved Jesus and dreamed about the kingdom of God that he had taught them about. They were also following along, weeping over this terrible, unstoppable nightmare. Even now, Jesus tries to draw their attention away from his own immediate suffering to the dreadful suffering that was coming upon that city and those people for what they had done. Verse 32, it says, two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Crucifixions were done outside the city of Jerusalem at a place called Golgotha, which means skull. The Latin equivalent is Calvaria, from which we get our word Calvary. Try to picture in your mind what this place was like. This is where all of the executions are done. The ground is littered with the remains of hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of executions that have taken place here before. The sickening smell of dead bodies fills the air. Vultures circle overhead. The sounds of weeping and wailing by children and women can be heard. It's a dark, disgusting, sad, horrifying place. This is where Jesus is executed. It's not a pristine, white, holy setting with 10,000 angels singing Handel's Messiah with the sweet smell of incense in the air. It's a place of death. It's a place of defilement. It's a place where the lowest, poorest, most vile criminals are disposed of. Death by crucifixion was a very humiliating, painful, torturous way to die. First, the person was stripped naked. Then they would have large iron spikes driven through each of the person's wrists into the crossbeam. They would do the same with the person's feet, attaching them to the upright post. The person would then hang there until they died. Death usually came slowly through exhaustion, thirst, and eventually suffocation. The person would finally die when he became too weak to lift himself up enough to breathe. The length of time it would take for someone to die could vary widely depending upon the physical condition of the person and the extent of injuries that they've already suffered beforehand. For Jesus, because of the physical beatings that he has already suffered and the special nature of his death, it came within just a few hours. For some, it could actually take days. I'm going to turn the lights off. Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, he saved others. Let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, the chosen one. The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." There was a written notice above him which read, "This is the king of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise." It was now about the sixth hour, and darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain in the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." When he had said this, he breathed his last. The centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, "Surely this was a righteous man." When all the people who had gathered to witness this sight saw what took place, they beat their breasts and went away. But all those who knew him, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. The innocent died in place of the guilty that day. The God of the universe loves the people of this planet so much that he sent his Son to die in their place so that the guilty could share in the benefits and the blessings of the innocent. Every resident of this planet is guilty before God because we have pushed God out of our life. We have refused to recognize and submit to his authority over us. We've chosen to make up our own standards of right and wrong rather than follow God's standards of right and wrong. And we have rejected God's love extended toward us. But God said that we can be forgiven and set free from fear and guilt by accepting his gift, his Son's selfless act of dying in our place. And the question that I ask each of you is, have you accepted God's gift? You can do that today if you've not. Right here in this moment you can. And begin a new life in relationship with God through Jesus Christ. Isaiah 53:5. The prophecy was spoken hundreds of years before the death of Jesus. Said he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Let's bow our heads. Father, as we reflect on the death of your Son today, I pray that the message that was spoken through that unbelievable act on his part, on your part, touches the hearts of each of us, Lord. I pray for those who have never received your gift before, never entered into a relationship with you, have never acknowledged and received the sacrificial act of Jesus as their own, that today they would do that. For those of us who have, Lord, I pray that today we would have a fresh view of the expression of love that is seen in the work of Jesus, in his life, in his death. I ask you to bless your people today in Christ's name. Amen.